News.
Today is Thursday, January 6th, 2022, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. It's been 1 year since rioters attacked the U.S. Capitol. Some of the hundreds arrested now say it was a mistake.
I was trying to get more known for conservative content and getting views on YouTube.
On the one-year anniversary, President Biden delivered a fiery speech blaming former President Trump for spreading a web of lies.
I will defend this nation. Not allow no one to place a dagger at the throat of democracy.
Mass protests continue in Sudan. One analyst calls the political crisis there extremely serious. And in Kazakhstan, protests over a steep hike in fuel prices turns deadly. We'll have these stories and more next. It's been 1 year since hundreds of supporters of former President Donald Trump ransacked the U.S. Capitol. Rioters tried to stop Congress from certifying the results of the U.S. presidential election. U.S. President Joe Biden laid blame for the insurrection at the feet of former President Trump. Biden said Trump created a web of lies to pursue power over principle in a speech Thursday morning at the U.S. Capitol's Statuary Hall to mark the anniversary.
I will stand in this breach. I will defend this nation. Not allow no one to place a dagger at the throat of democracy. We will make sure the will of the people is heard, that the ballot prevails, not violence, that authority in this nation will always be peacefully transferred.
In a forceful speech, Biden said for the first time in our history, a president not just lost an election, he tried to prevent the peaceful transfer of power as a violent mob breached the Capitol, but they failed. He went on to say, I will stand in this breach. Biden said democracy was attacked. We, the people, prevailed. In her speech just before Biden spoke, Vice President Kamala Harris said, Americans must unite in defense of our democracy. On Wednesday, U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland addressed the insurrection in a speech to Justice Department employees. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell discussed the speech with me.
He laid this out and addressed the fact that some people are frustrated that this case hasn't been moving fast enough, number one, and that so far, as you mentioned, they've only charged about 700 people who were, to put a term to it, foot soldiers, you know, just the private, the people on the ground and not the people who were behind the scenes. He gave a few explanations for why this is so. Number one, he said, there's a pandemic on, it makes it very hard to impanel a jury, a grand jury, and to do court business. Number two, this case is extremely, extremely complex. I think he said it was the most complex case that the Justice Department had done in quite some time. Number three, he said, what usually happens in complex cases like this is that the lesser charges come down first. What happens is these attorneys are building to the bigger charges. So they're going to kind of sweep up the low-hanging fruit first before they go for the gems. And so those are the three reasons he said. But he did say some interesting things yesterday. He said, for example, we will prosecute at any level, whether you were there or not on the grounds of the Capitol, which leaves the door open to interpretation that he's talking about people in the former president's inner circle or even the former president himself.
Have we heard anything from the leaders of the congressional panel on Capitol Hill and where they plan to go from here?
Right now, they're still trying to talk to key figures, including Stephanie Grisham, who is the former First Lady's chief of staff and then was press secretary for a while, although she did not do a single press briefing when she was press secretary. So they're still trying to talk to people high up in that orbit. They've summoned some people, and their level of cooperation has varied widely. Stephanie Grisham is probably going to cooperate. As you know, she recently released a book and has been very contrite about her time in the Trump White House, so it is likely she will cooperate. So they are going through the ranks and trying to talk to more and more people and to basically get to the bottom of it.
Some of the Democrats serving on the committee spoke on some of the TV shows last weekend about it and said that there could be subpoenas happening with higher level people within weeks, possibly months. Is that correct?
Yes. And it remains to be seen how that's going to play out, because, as you know, members of Trump's inner circle have reacted differently to these subpoenas. As you recall, Steve Bannon was very resistant. Mark Meadows, the former chief of staff, initially cooperated and then stopped cooperating. Roger Stone, a close Trump ally, pled the fifth. So we're going to probably see a lot of resistance from some of his very close allies.
That was VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell. She was speaking to me in Washington on Thursday. More than 725 people have been arrested since last year's January 6th attack. A year later, some of the rioters who were sentenced for a variety of crimes are speaking out about that day and their actions. VOA's Carolyn Prosciutto has this report.
Of the thousands of supporters of former President Trump who stormed the Capitol, more than 725 have been arrested and charged with crimes. Floridian Robert Scott Palmer received the stiffest sentence yet, more than 5 years for assaulting a police officer with a dangerous weapon. Palmer was seen in video spraying officers with a fire extinguisher, then throwing the canister at police. VOA was scheduled to interview Palmer, but he is in jail in quarantine after catching COVID. In a letter to the judge before sentencing, Palmer blamed former President Donald Trump and his advisors, writing, "They kept spitting out the false narrative about a stolen election and how it was our duty to stand up to tyranny."
Pause, guys. Come on, let's go.
Another Capitol rioter from Florida, Felipe Marquez, says fake stories about human trafficking led him to join the uprising and to invade a senator's office. Marquez pleaded guilty to disorderly conduct in a restricted building and received 18 months probation. He told VOA in an email, "I would like to leave this in my past as a mistake.
I was trying to get more known for conservative content and getting views on YouTube, and the way the events of that day folded were terrible."
Name, gender, state.
John Lewis with George Washington University's program on extremism is tracking each case of those who stormed the Capitol.
You have defendants from 18 to 80 years old. You have individuals from every walk of life, from a salon owner to other business owners to firemen to law enforcement to military.
More than 80% were charged based on evidence gathered from social media posts, often their own, like Texan Jennifer Ryan, who gained notoriety after tweeting a photo in front of a broken window at the Capitol, along with a tweet that read, "We just stormed the Capitol. It was one of the best days of my life." Ryan later tweeted that she was not going to jail because she is blonde and white. Here's what she said as she left the courthouse after pleading guilty to demonstrating inside the Capitol and receiving a 60-day sentence.
"I walked into the Capitol for 2 minutes and I'm remorseful of that."
Ryan claimed her tweets, not her actions at the Capitol, got her into trouble.
"I regret ever tweeting, but, you know, it's a free country."
Some of those charged, like Yvonne St. Cyr, are unrepentant.
"I own what I do. But I still believe in what I did was the right thing."
Others are not commenting on their case, including the man who propped his feet onto House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's desk and allegedly stole some of her mail. Instead, Richard Barnett, who faces 7 charges, is complaining about jail conditions, including solitary confinement.
"You can love me, you can hate me. You can love me and hate what I did. You can not like anything about me. But you have to put that aside. Because this isn't about me. This is about our federal prison system in America and what they are doing to people."
Trials have been avoided so far as defendants have accepted plea bargains, sometimes for a lesser charge. Court observers say hundreds of remaining cases will take years to adjudicate. Carolyn Prosciutto, VOA News, Washington.
In an interview, Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney, the top Republican on the House of Representatives panel that is investigating the Capitol riot, says the panel has firsthand testimony that former President Trump was watching the Capitol attack unfold on TV.
"He could have at any moment walked the very few steps to the White House briefing room. He could have gone on the air and told the people who were his supporters assaulting the Capitol to go home. He did not do that. And we are very focused on the minute-by-minute activities at the White House, what he was doing."
That was Wyoming Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney speaking on the NBC Today show. Cheney has broken with the Republican Party leadership by taking part in the House investigation of the January 6th riot and by opposing former President Trump. The top Republican in the U.S. Senate on Thursday accused congressional Democrats of trying to use the anniversary of the attack on the Capitol for political gain. Ahead of Biden's speech, Senator Mitch McConnell said January 6th had been a dark day, but called it stunning to see some Washington Democrats try to exploit this anniversary. Most Republican leaders on Capitol Hill have avoided the events marking the anniversary. Gunfire echoed through the streets of Kazakhstan's largest city on Thursday as Moscow-led troops arrived to help quell mass unrest that left dozens dead and hundreds detained. A reporter for the French news agency AFP said fighting appeared to continue a day after protesters stormed several government buildings. Authorities in Kazakhstan say dozens of protesters were killed in attacks on government buildings and at least 12 police officers died. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has more.
One of the dead officers was found beheaded. A state news channel has reported police saying there were attempts to storm buildings in Almaty overnight and dozens of attackers liquidated, they say. The reported attempts to storm the buildings came after widespread unrest in the city on Wednesday, including seizure of the mayor's building, which was set on fire. The news channel cites the city commandant's office as saying well over 300 law enforcement officers were injured in addition to those killed. Kazakhstan is experiencing the worst street protests the country has seen since gaining independence. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Sudanese demonstrators flooded the streets of Khartoum, Omdurman, and Port Sudan on Thursday, chanting no to military rule as the country plunged further into turmoil following the resignation of Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok. Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi just how serious the situation is in Sudan.
The situation is serious. However, Sudan has been in crisis really since the October 25th coup, when the military effectively hijacked the democratic transition. You know, since that time, there have been estimated 60 protesters who've been killed by the military, and many more women have been raped, and other protesters have been injured. You know, more generally, the economy faces a huge crisis. They're looking at 700% inflation. Goods and supplies are increasingly difficult to come by. And this is on top of an economy that has been contracting since the latter years of the Bashir regime and faces huge debt. You know, all of these things are what led to the massive protests we saw in 2019. We're also, you know, hearing worrying reports that the conflicts in Darfur and South Kordofan may be resuming. So the situation is very serious, but it's not because of the Hamdok resignation. Rather, it's because of the military coup and its efforts to derail the democratic transition, which is what would provide a path out of this crisis.
Protest movement insists on a fully civilian government to lead the transition, a demand rejected by the generals who say power will be handed over only to an elected government in July of next year. Protesters have said that 2022 will be the year of the continuation of the resistance as they push for an immediate transition to civilian rule. Hamdok said in his resignation announcement he had failed to find a compromise between the ruling generals and pro-democracy movement. Judging from a long military grip on politics in Sudan, is there a way out?
Well, I believe there is a way out. And in fact, I would say that Sudan was making notable progress in addressing a lot of the factors underlying its crisis. Since the transition began in 2019, we were seeing progress on the economy. The civilian-led government was addressing corruption. The internal conflicts were being resolved. And so there is already a roadmap for how to get out of the crisis. And it involves reinstituting a civilian-led democratic government. The military has undermined this process because it is accustomed to governing. The military in Sudan has been in power in one way or another for all but 10 years since Sudan's independence in 1955. However, you know, this type of government, an authoritarian-led military government in Sudan, is what has led to the economic crisis and the hugely underperforming development conditions in Sudan. It's what has contributed to the civil wars that we've seen. So the only way that Sudan is going to come out of this and to get the massive levels of foreign investment that it's going to need to stabilize the economy is with a credible civilian-led democratic government. And that's something we were starting to see since 2019. There was an outpouring of international support for Sudan. So the military really is isolated. You know, it's navigated itself into a blind alley where there's no way it's going to get the assistance that it needs to work its way out of the crisis. It's going to have to negotiate with the civilians to return to a civilian government that will have credibility. And while that may seem unappealing to the military, it has advantages. You know, the military will continue to play an important role in Sudan. It will have an opportunity to professionalize and reform. And it won't be faced with dealing with these internal conflicts. And it should remember that, you know, a stable economy and a growing economy is going to mean more revenues for the military over time. So I think for all these reasons, there is a way forward that can be negotiated.
That is Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He was speaking to VOA's Mohamed Elshenawy. Australian authorities canceled the visa for world tennis number one Novak Djokovic, and he is facing deportation. He had received a COVID-19 vaccination exemption to defend his title at the Australian Open, but reportedly failed to provide proper evidence to border officials. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Serbian Novak Djokovic is the defending Australian Open champion and a nine-time winner of the event. But the government said Thursday he's no longer welcome. The world number one was detained at Melbourne Airport on Wednesday for several hours before Border Force officials announced that he'd not met immigration regulations and would be deported. Djokovic's father had claimed his son was being held captive. Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić said he was a victim of harassment. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison is standing firm, though.
On the issue of Mr. Djokovic, rules are rules. And there are no special cases. That's the policy of the government and has been our government's strong border protection policies, and particularly in relation to the pandemic, that has ensured that Australia has one of the lowest death rates from COVID anywhere in the world. Entry with a visa requires double vaccination or a medical exemption. I'm advised that such an exemption was not in place, and as a result, he is subject to the same rule as anyone else.
With his visa revoked, Djokovic is now an unlawful non-citizen in Australia and is being held in immigration detention, where his movements are restricted after he was driven from Melbourne Airport by government officials. It's also unclear whether Djokovic is allowed to communicate with his advisers, which is standard practice according to Australian law. His lawyers are challenging the deportation order in Australia's Federal Circuit Court. The 34-year-old tennis star hasn't publicly confirmed his COVID-19 vaccination status. He flew to Australia after being granted a controversial medical exemption. Tennis authorities said he'd not received any special treatment, but many Australians who've lived under some of the world's toughest coronavirus restrictions believe Djokovic had abused the system. Australia's states and territories Thursday reported more than 70,000 new COVID-19 cases. A total of 612,000 infections have been diagnosed in Australia since the pandemic began, according to official figures. 2,289 people have died. More than 90% of the eligible population have been fully vaccinated. To curb the spread of the virus, the Northern Territory imposed lockdown restrictions Thursday on unvaccinated residents, who must adhere to stay-at-home orders until next Monday. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to VOA News. Jeffrey Feltman is stepping down as U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa. He will be replaced by David Satterfield, who has been serving as U.S. Ambassador to Turkey. Feltman's decision to resign after more than 9 months on the job comes as the veteran diplomat remains involved in U.S. efforts to resolve Ethiopia's civil war. Feltman travels to Ethiopia Thursday to discuss peace talks with government officials. Cameron Hudson, a non-resident senior fellow with the Atlantic Council's Africa Center, tells VOA's Jackson Mubganye the U.S. can still pressure the stakeholders in the crisis in both Ethiopia and Sudan.
What does Feltman's departure say about efforts to bring peace to the Horn of Africa? What would you say have been his main achievements, given that the war is still ongoing in Ethiopia?
Well, I'm sure he would probably say that he's not entirely satisfied with the conditions that he's leaving his portfolio in, because you're right, the conflict in Ethiopia is still very much going on, although perhaps there's a new opening for some kind of ceasefire to emerge right now, given the withdrawal of Tigrayan forces out of Amhara and Afar. But I think that, you know, he leaves a mixed legacy, quite frankly. But I think, you know, to be fair, this is the first time we've ever had an envoy to the Horn of Africa region. He came into the job before we had an assistant secretary. So before many of the key roles in the administration had been filled out. So he was very much, I think, came in as a stopgap to provide some leadership and some diplomatic engagement at a time when the Biden administration very early on was still filling out its team. So I think it's fair to say he did not have a full support system around him when he came into the job. And so I think he has filled out that. He has gotten, I think, the administration off to a reasonably good start, but clearly there's a lot more work to be done.
Ambassador David Satterfield, who is a former ambassador to Turkey, will be replacing Feltman. What does that tell you about the Biden administration's commitment or efforts to bring peace to this region?
Well, I think it is a good suggestion that they take it seriously, that they understand that there is an unfinished job to be done. I think it also hopefully is a recognition of the fact that we don't have proper diplomatic recognition in the region. We don't have an ambassador in Somalia presently. We don't have an ambassador in Sudan. And so if you're not going to have ambassadorial level representation on the ground, then you absolutely need some kind of envoy, I think, if there are crisis situations as they are in the Horn of Africa right now. So I think it's a good recognition on their part that we cannot afford to leave a diplomatic vacuum at this critical moment.
That was Cameron Hudson, a non-resident senior fellow with the Atlantic Council's Africa Center. He was speaking with my colleague Jackson Mvunganyi. The James Webb Space Telescope has passed one of its biggest hurdles in its mission to get images of the first stars in the universe. Controllers on Tuesday completed the deployment of the Space Observatory's giant sun shield. With a massive kite-shaped shield, the telescope will have the sensitivity to detect the signals coming from the most distant objects in the cosmos. Pope Francis chastised conservatives resisting change in the Roman Catholic Church on Thursday, lamenting those whose religion, he said, was self-referential and encased in what he called a suit of armor. On the Feast of the Epiphany, Francis appeared to direct specific criticism at those who are unhappy with his decision to restrict the traditionalist Latin Mass, saying the liturgy could not be trapped in a dead language. The Latin Mass went out of general use in the 1960s and was replaced by local languages. This year's Grammy Awards ceremony honoring top performances in music has been postponed indefinitely because of the rapid spread of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. The Grammy Awards have been postponed for a second year in a row because of this pandemic. The ceremony, which honors the top performances in music, was scheduled to take place at the end of the month. That's all we have for you today on VOA's International Edition. On behalf of Managing Editor Kate Dawson, producer Nadia Taha, and the entire production team, thanks so much for listening. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington.
next Straight Talk Africa. We'll take a look at informal housing. As cities develop, are we making space for them in big urban centers? Join me, Heidi Adams, for that discussion on the next Straight Talk Africa, this Wednesday.